Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the Feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that help you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. Well, okay, okay, we went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It should be about 5 a.m., and you're listening to all, oh, that's one big comet, Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
And we're going to talk about various things on this program, and you can find out a little bit more about them by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. When you get there, you'll get a blue navigation frame in the left-hand side of your screen. At the top, it will say latest back-of-the-book program links. Click on that, and you'll get to the webpage for this morning's radio program. The WBAI website and the archives seem to be working this time around. And so there we go. And they were fixed last time, too. This is our 88th pandemic episode of Back of the Book. It's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning. If things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we will be referencing them on this program. A recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program, but this is what we have to do in these dangerous times. And the top story of the week, of course, is on Twitter, we are still holding at 118 followers. Oh, yes, tremendous numbers. There will be another executive session WBAI local station board meeting held on Monday, April 25th. The next thrill-packed episode of the WBAI local station board that you can pay rapt attention to will be held on Wednesday, May 11th at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. According to the Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 508,355,497 on Friday, and global deaths reached 6,214,658. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 80,901,424, and the death toll in America was 990,972. So 2,554 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. This week's death rate is down once again significantly from last week's, at least in America. The BA2 subvariant of the Omicron variant is the dominant one of COVID-19 at this time, and there are a lot of hospitalizations in Europe. Yeah, the pandemic is not over. By the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of those figures we quoted will be higher, of course. This was all mostly preventable. And this past week, Catherine Kimball Mizell, a federal judge appointed by Donnie Bonespur Trump after he'd lost the 2020 election, struck down the federal mask mandate on airplanes and public transportation, ruling that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, had no authority to implement such a mandate. Mizell also stated that the CDC improperly invoked the good faith exception to the Administrative Procedure Act's notice and comment rulemaking process. It's important to note that the U.S. Supreme Court had 3 times refused to issue injunctions against the CDC's mask mandate. So the Supreme Court won't do it, but this Trump judge in Florida does it, causing chaos. The American Bar Association's Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary, which rates the qualifications of federal judicial nominees, rated Mizell, quote, not qualified, unquote, to serve as a federal trial court judge, noting that, quote, since her admission to the bar, Ms. Mizell has not tried a case, civil or criminal, as lead or co-counsel, unquote. So she wasn't even doing much of anything there. God. That's as a lawyer, she didn't even do these things. And she's appointed as a federal judge by Trump. Before her appointment, she had only taken part in 2 trials, both one-day trials in a state court conducted while she was still in law school, which is a sort of thing you need to do to graduate law school, to get some kind of bare experience. So now this Florida judge is causing chaos in America in line with the Republican Party's objections to mandates to keep people from dying from COVID-19 in even greater numbers. And the MTA is keeping mask mandates for the subways in New York City. Too bad they can't keep mandates for people not shooting other people. But, so the MTA is saying, screw you, we're going to keep doing this. It's important that we keep doing this. So, you know, I don't think anybody's going to do much to attack the MTA over this and force them to not have people wear masks. On the other hand, the administration is going to appeal this because this is a terrible ruling, and it basically says the CDC doesn't have the power to do its job, which is a lot like what I think Trump and the Republican Party would like.
R. Paul, do you think this will end up with the Supreme Court? Is that how that works?
Or? It may, because she has made a ruling, whereas previously the Supreme Court has simply refused to take the case. There have been 3 attempts to shove this into the Supreme Court and have them issue an injunction like this, and they've just not done it. And a lot of them are Trump appointees as well, although I guess they probably have some more qualifications than this doofus Mizell here. Jesus Christ, she wasn't even qualified much as an attorney, and she becomes a federal judge. Ah, boy, oh boy, have to look and see if there was any kind of exchange of anything between Trump and this woman. Gee, what could she have exchanged with him for? Oh, yeah.
Well, they're both unsuited and unfit, so.
Yeah, well.
Birds of a feather.
We all suffer now.
I must say, walking around outside on Friday, nary a mask to be seen.
Wow.
It was just really awful because anybody who immunization does not work for, people who are have their immune systems compromised, little children who don't qualify to get a vaccine yet, all these people are just like, it's like, well, you're on your own, folks. And it's just really, really awful. And I was getting a lot of stink eyes from people who were walking around without any masks because I was wearing a mask. So.
And the war in Ukraine grinds on. Russia, of course, invaded Ukraine, what, like 8 weeks ago or something? And this is still going on. They thought it was going to be 3 days and they'd conquer Kyiv and that would be it. They'd own Ukraine. Ain't working out that way. And war criminal Putin continues to engage in genocide. They're just bombing people and just killing as many Ukrainians as possible. I guess the idea is to depopulate the place and then flood it with Russians. This is an old way of doing things. The Mongols did it. A lot of different groups did this hundreds and thousands of years ago. You go in, you kill everybody, and you take over and you bring your own people in there. Russia certainly has a large enough population that they can thinly populate the remains of Ukraine after they kill everybody, I suppose. I think there's going to be some abiding dislike of Russia going on for, another century or so. I mean, the Armenian genocide by the Turks actually the first one started in like the 1880s, but the big one everybody knows about was 1915, where the Turks went in and just genocided Armenians, which the Turks deny still. And the evidence is gigantic, but the Turks don't care. And so, there's still people who are remembering that, and this is going to be remembered too. This is going to be a terrible thing that people will remember a century from now. Well, I didn't get my second booster shot on Monday. Things just didn't work out. I also didn't go to an emergency room to see if anything can easily be done to get my jaw lined up again, since I appear to have dislocated it. The dislocation is my own diagnosis, so that might be wrong. But I think the jaw is getting better. It is getting better, but it's still a bit bothersome. And yeah, I should probably go see somebody and say, is this thing messed up and can it be fixed? And hope they don't wire my jaw shut. That would be a real bother.
Oh, my goodness.
Could happen.
That would be horrible.
Yeah. I'd be doing a radio program like this.
I'd have to take lots of pictures.
Which could be an improvement.
Oh, no.
Today, sort of, when this program airs, will be April 23rd. We're actually recording it the day before, and it's Oit Day. Yes, it's Oit Day once again. The planet Oit, we're paying attention to here. April 23rd is kind of a rememberable day around here. One, it's the birthday of William Shakespeare. And it's the birthday of my male ex. Shakespeare was born 458 years ago. My male ex was born 75 years ago. Yes, and both those people are no longer with us, sadly. And, I just wanted to mention those two birthdays. So there you go. Stuff's coming at us. Yes, NASA says it spotted the biggest comet nucleus ever seen. And this comet nucleus is between 75 and 85 miles in diameter. That's big. And it's called C/2014 UN271. Remember that name. Also known as Bernardinelli-Bernstein. which are the names of two people who picked this information and found it by going through surveys. It was a dark matter survey that they were going through, and they found this thing in it. By comparison, Comet Hale-Bopp, you'll remember Comet Hale-Bopp years and years ago, decades ago now, I think. Comet Hale-Bopp was visible in our skies. It was a big deal. We all saw it. It was about 46 miles in diameter, and it was a big comet. This thing is much bigger. And this new big comet is an Oort cloud comet. The Oort cloud is the outermost part of the solar system. It consists of a lot of stuff that didn't get made into anything more substantial in the inner parts of the solar system. Because what generally happens is, and they could observe this in the sky, is a bunch of gas and dust starts to accumulate. And once a little bit of it gets together, the gravity of a little bit starts adding to it and adding to it. And you get a nebula. And it's usually like a swirling thing because besides coming together, you also have angular momentum. And you can't just get rid of that. You have to conserve angular momentum in this universe. It's a law. And so you get this swirlpool of matter going around. And that's how solar systems are created. Eventually, enough of it accumulates at the center to form a star, and the star goes on, and there are other clumps in the swirling mass, and those frequently can become planets, not always. And once the star lights up, it starts putting out all of its radiation, and it starts driving out the finer particles. And so that's why they figure most solar systems are going to have rocky planets like the Earth, Venus, Mercury, and Mars in the inner part of that system. And in the outer part, you're going to have things like Jupiter and Saturn, which are gas giants, and then Uranus and Neptune are ice giants. Then, of course, you have Pluto, which we all argue about, which is just an ice ball out there. And people, you know, it got demoted from a planet. It's a dwarf planet now. And it's sort of just a thing in the Kuiper Belt, which is more icy stuff that's out there. But the Oort cloud is very extensive. It goes out to like 2.5 light years from the sun. So it goes out there. And the stuff that's there is mostly ice because it's more easily driven out. Ice would have, either as ice or as water vapor, would have been easily driven out of the inner solar system by the sun when it turned on. And then it got way out, and it wasn't so warm anymore. So it started to become ice, and it accumulates. And not a hell of a lot is known about the population of the Oort cloud. And they want to know more about it. But this comet, Bernardinelli Bernstein, we'll call it that instead of that more formal name. This thing is from the Oort cloud, and it appears to be approaching the sun at about 22,000 miles an hour, which is not particularly fast. It was discovered just inside the orbit of Neptune, which is the farthest out that any comet has been discovered. And that's because it's so humongous. And it's predicted that this comet is going to reach perihelion, that is, the closest approach to the sun, at about 10.9 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the sun. It's about 93 million miles or so. So this is going to be 10.9 times that distance. And it's going to be just outside the orbit of the planet Saturn. So it's not going to get very close to the sun at all. And that perihelion outside Saturn's orbit is going to occur in January 2031. So not very soon by human standards. And the comet cannot be seen with the naked eye, and it will not get into the inner solar system, so there will be no big sight in the night sky from it, which is probably maybe a good thing. We don't want something like that rattling around inside in the inner solar system. I mean, God, 75 to 85 miles in diameter. Well, you don't want to bump into that kind of thing. And it's estimated that this comet is 100,000 times more massive than a typical comet. Again, you don't want to get smacked with a thing like that. This shows that we really do need to keep funding the searches for incoming celestial bodies. If this comet had a different trajectory, we might be looking at an attempt to deflect it from hitting the Earth. That'd be difficult, something that big. And most of the time they talk about how to deflect comets that might be 5 or 6 miles wide. The comet that destroyed helped to destroy the dinosaurs was about 6 miles wide. And this thing is more than 10 times that. Oh boy, it's something we have to be aware of, that we must keep watching for this kind of thing. Geez, we're lucky that this thing is just going to be getting as close as outside the orbit of Saturn. So it'll be a billion miles away or something. Yeah, we might be seeing all sorts of attempts to deflect it, although those attempts that they've talked about were for things much smaller. How to deal with a 75 to 85 mile in diameter ball of ice that might just decide to smack you one day. That'd be hard to do, although given all that time, we would probably be able to go out there and do something about it, maybe. Currently, some Harvard astronomers are speculating that a meteor from beyond the solar system zipped through Earth's atmosphere recently, another interstellar interloper. Last month, the U.S. Space Command, good grief, what a silly thing, released a memo to NASA scientists that stated the data from the missile warning satellites centers, quote, was sufficiently accurate to indicate an interstellar trajectory for that particular meteor that whipped through our atmosphere. But NASA said in a public statement this month that, quote, the short duration of collected data, less than 5 seconds, makes it difficult to definitively determine if the object's origin was indeed interstellar, unquote. So there's an argument between some Harvard scientists and the military, which has these satellites that are set up to mostly detect nuclear detonations, and NASA about did this meteor that didn't land, didn't hit us, it went through our atmosphere and went away, did this thing come from interstellar space? And so we have this big controversy here.
I have a question that I think you may be able to answer.
Oh, my godlessness.
Now, if this very large comet were not on a trajectory to, you know, smush the Earth, but was on one where we would be able to see it with the naked eye, what would something like that look like?
Well, you remember Hale-Bopp?
Yes.
It was, you know, it would be the same usual comet thing, except it would be much bigger and probably much brighter because it's, you know, much bigger than in your ordinary comet. Of course, that means also that being between 75 and 85 miles in diameter, it has an enormous surface on it. It has a lot of surface to it, and it would all of that would be outgassing as it approached the sun. It probably is outgassing as it's approaching the sun. In fact, it had a little burst of something on it, but it's, you know, so far out that the sun's radiation is quite feeble out there. So it did a little something, but it's nothing anybody will ever be able to see. But if it were on a trajectory where it were going to come in closer to the sun and not hit us, we would get quite a spectacular comet to see. And we would see it coming toward the sun, and we'd see it going away from the sun, because something this big isn't going to fall apart like, what was that comet's name? I forget the comet's name. Last year, the year before, started with an I. I can't remember it. It was coming in, and it was going to be so spectacular, and then it got to the other side of the sun, and it just vaporized, literally vaporized. It was seen with telescopes going in. It wasn't spectacular going in, but they said it's going to flare up when it comes out the other side of the sun. But it did its flaring up where we couldn't see it, on with the sun between us and it. So that thing fizzled. There was also, of course, the infamous comet Kohoutek. Kohoutek was the one that fizzled. We had all this publicity. It was going to be the greatest comet of the 20th century, and you couldn't see it. If you had a telescope, you could see it. And in a telescope, it wasn't terribly thrilling. Because there are comets to be seen with telescopes all the time. There are a lot of these damn things flying around out there. Hyakutake and Hale-Bopp were the two late 20th century comets, and we all got to see them both. If this Bernardinelli-Bernstein comet had followed that kind of a trajectory, it would have been a very interesting sight. I don't know what its period would be, when it would return. Is it Hale-Bopp returns in 4,200 years? Some of these comets, you know, take a long time. For instance, Halley's Comet is 76 years. And other comets are similar. Some comets are much more frequently seen. And this big thing here coming right out of the Oort cloud, hard to tell what would happen with it because, of course, it's coming through the outer solar system. It's going to be affected by all of that. And it's coming in for its first shot. And it's not in resonance, most likely, with any of the outer planets. Some of the comets are. And so, yeah, the odds are, I think, that it would come in, go out, and nobody alive today would ever see it again. But we'd be able to say, hey, in the early 20th century and in the 2030s, we got to see this humongous comet in the sky, and there would be films about it, and there would be paintings and everything, as there are with other visible comets of the past. But it ain't gonna happen. And right about now, I think it's time for us to do a station break. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a transmitter and antenna atop 4 Times Square, going through a new studio somewhere in downtown Brooklyn and originating in our living room somewhere else in Brooklyn. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. And you can find out more by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can also go to the official website of this radio station at wbai.org. Meanwhile, in other astronomical news, astronomers have made the first confirmed detection of a stellar mass black hole that's completely alone. Black holes are hard to detect because, of course, they don't allow light to escape from. The actual black hole has three parts, the ones we figure we know about. And there's the singularity, which is a huge amount of matter compressed into a volume smaller than a proton, which means an entire star or number of stars in a space that's smaller than a proton. And then you have the event horizon, which is the place farther out. It's a sphere farther out from the singularity where, well, it's the boundary between really the black hole and the rest of the universe, because light cannot escape from the event horizon. And then the third thing you have, usually, is the accretion disk. Because with all of that gravity, tremendous gravity, you start attracting stuff. And so all of these things start coming in. Remember before I talked about angular momentum being conserved? Well, a lot of stuff will fall in toward the black hole, and it'll have different angular momentum. It'll come from one direction, another direction. It'll come from above and below. And all of these things are getting captured, and they all have angular momentum. And angular momentum, a record player, oh, God. Well, you got to be old enough to remember this stuff. A record player has angular momentum, like if you have a 33 and a third RPM record going around, an old LP. I still have some. I don't have anything to play them on, unfortunately. And that has a certain angular momentum, okay? And I'm not going to get too far into angular momentum. I promise you I won't get too far into angular momentum, but it's there. And it's also the thing where the classic thing of the ice skater, when the ice skater has his or her hands next to her body while spinning, they go faster. And then when they put their arms out, they spin more slowly because they have to conserve angular momentum. Anyway, angular momentum is conserved. And so all of that stuff that's trying to fall into the black hole is colliding with all the other stuff. And it usually, that's usually the way you can find a black hole, is it sort of lights up that accretion disk. And M87, a large galaxy far, far away, I'm glad to say, they've actually imaged the central supermassive black hole of M87. And so you've seen pictures of that. M87, it has a black hole that has what are called jets, where at the north and south poles of the black hole, it's shooting out matter. And we won't get into that too much. But anyway, so that's how you see generally a black hole. However, that usually occurs because the black hole has a companion star, and the black hole is stealing matter from the companion star. And between the black hole and the star, they've probably got some other stuff around them, and that's how they get an accretion disk. Well, these scientists believe they have found a black hole that has no companion. And if it has an accretion disk, it's not exactly prominent. And so black holes are very hard to detect. Hundreds of black holes have been detected so far, but their accretion disks usually give them away. This black hole doesn't have one, or at least it's too small to detect. So this black hole was detected through microlensing. And microlensing is where the gravity of the black hole magnifies something way in back of it, and it acts like a magnifying glass, and you can see something that you ordinarily couldn't see. Or you may see a distorted background to it. And in some cases, astronomers have already pictures of the field that this thing would be in, and they can look at it now and look at it before and say, there's a distortion over here. And so that's basically what the scientists did. The microlensing changes the background, and they said, hey, there's something there, and we can't see it. It's probably a black hole. And they're calling it a rogue black hole because it's all alone. And if one of these, we were talking before about watching out for stuff coming in at us. If one of these black holes, were heading toward the solar system, we might easily not see it until it started affecting things. Because you've got to really be looking for the damn thing to notice the microlensing. It's not a big event. It's something small. And, you know, you need the big telescopes like the Hubble and stuff like that to notice it. And so this rogue black hole, if this thing or something like it were heading to the solar system, we might have a problem. It wouldn't have to be on a collision with the Earth to be a problem. Like the comet, if that comet were on a collision course with the Earth, it would be a problem. If it were just whipping around, not that much of a problem, not really a problem at all. However, a black hole would be, because it would be multiple times the mass of the sun. And its gravity could affect the Earth and other things in the solar system. It could disrupt the Oort cloud and send a gigantic amount of big comets like this other one, like this Bernardelli-Bernstein, get a whole bunch of those flying in at us. Or it could come in and start affecting the planetary orbits. And if it got into the solar system that deeply to where the planets are, it would probably also start affecting the sun, because the sun wouldn't weigh as much. The black hole would become the central thing, or try to become the central thing, of the solar system. And we might end up with some of the planets orbiting it, maybe all the planets orbiting it, and the sun orbiting it the way the planets do. And how might that work? Oh, that could be bad news. And also, as a black hole, it could do things like, swallow planets. If something like that were on a collision course with Earth, it wouldn't be a solid object hitting a solid object. It would be the black hole coming in, attracting the Earth. And the first thing it would do is it would strip off the atmosphere and nothing flat if it got close enough. And, that would be it for us. And then the rest of it would be academic. It would slowly consume the Earth. Luckily, that doesn't seem to be happening, we're glad to say. But there are all sorts of scenarios, as I said before, for how to deal with something coming into the solar system that is big. And none of those solutions would apply to a rogue black hole coming in. So, well, we're lucky it ain't coming in here, and we, right now, we can probably forget about that sort of thing, except if you want to write a science fiction story, because there is absolutely nothing anybody could do about it. We don't have enough stuff to be able to get off the planet to get some of humanity onto another planet. It wouldn't matter if we went to Mars, because Mars would be just as likely to get eaten too. So, we might as well just forget about a black hole collision with the solar system and say, yeah, to hell with it. In fact, it could also, of course, plow into the sun. That would be a disaster. And Scientific American had a piece years ago describing what would happen if a white dwarf star collided with the sun. And, it was an interesting exercise. A white dwarf star is a star that has run out of all of its fuel. It's very old, and it's very dense, but small. It's about, a white dwarf star is about the size of the Earth, but it can weigh as much as the sun or a bit more. And so in the scenario from Scientific American years ago, it hits the sun, and in the space of minutes to an hour, the day side of the Earth gets incinerated. And of course, again, the atmosphere is blown away and the oceans boil, and the people on the night side of the Earth will have maybe minutes extra to see it go. I mean, there was a science fiction story written years ago called Inconstant Moon, where an astronomer sees the moon and he notices it's got some weird coloration and it's bright, too bright. And he realizes, he knows what this means. The sun has either, somehow exploded or has put out a coronal mass ejection that is gigantic. And so, and the story follows what he does after that and hoping to try and survive. And the Saddle Pals and Pickles of the North and Rat Girl of the West have what are called our Inconstant Moon Protocols, where if that happens, we're all going to get together and forget about taking medications for diabetes or whatever, and we're going to eat what we like, have all the malted milks we please, do everything we want. If we want to get drunk off our asses, we'll do it. We'll do whatever drugs we feel like doing, because the hell with it, we're doomed anyway. Luckily, we do not have to implement the inconstant moon protocols at this time. However, as they say at the end of the thing, keep watching the skies. And there's an old fixture in Greenwich Village. It's Julius's Bar. And it turns out that now it is the oldest surviving gay bar in Manhattan. And so, in New York City, I think. And so what happens is, it's on West 10th Street, and they're going to get a commemorative plaque saying this is the oldest gay bar. And they're going to have, Randy Wicker is going to be there. Some politicians will be there, and some gay politicians will be there. And Randy Wicker, who, by the way, made history as doing the, he was on WBAI in 1962 talking about being gay. And the Journal American then said they should pull the license from WBAI for having such a thing on the air. And later on, he went and became the first openly gay programmer at WBAI. And so he was doing various things, and he was the last survivor of an action called a sip-in at Julius's. And what happened was Julius's would discriminate. It was a gay bar that discriminated against gay people. Oh, yeah, this becomes interesting. And so you couldn't really be friendly with anybody. I remember public displays of affection weren't allowed or anything like this. And if you were homosexual, you couldn't be served. You know, it was a gay bar. And so Randy Wicker and a few other guys went in. They had their drinks. And then they finished their drinks and they announced, "We're all homosexuals. Give us another drink." And the bartender refused. And they had brought a reporter with them. And, of course, this all got publicity. And it was referred to as a sip-in as opposed to a sit-in. And so this got some publicity about anti-gay discrimination. And so they're going to be there. And Randy's the last surviving member of it. And he's going to be there. And they're going to commemorate all of this. Julius has had some problems in the 70s, too, I remember. We went there. The Gay Activist Alliance went there and, harangued them a bit. I think they threw Vito Russo out one time because of an open display of affection. I know, it's bizarre. It was the most closeted gay bar going, but that's what it was. Now, I think they're very different. I mean, obviously the guys who ran it are probably all dead. This woman owns it now, and she's, she puts gay flags out and celebrates. But Julius's wouldn't even accept leaflets. Julius's wouldn't allow us to put the calendar of events for lesbians and gay people in the bar, which was a calendar of what was happening in the gay community at one time. And they wouldn't allow that. And we picketed them once or twice, as I recall. So that was in the 70s. So they took a while before. I guess it just took until probably the 90s. And maybe people had died by then or something.
So this was a bar.
It still is a bar.
This is a bar that in its history was gay people what owned it or ran it?
Not sure who owned it, but I do know that it was a gay bar.
Where you were not allowed to be openly homosexual.
You couldn't kiss somebody. You couldn't put your arm around another male. Male and female could put her arm around, but one man couldn't put his arm around another man or,
So the benefit was you could go there as a gay man because it was a men's
yeah,
bar.
Yeah.
You could go there and there would just be other gay men there. And that was supposed to be enough.
Pretty much. Julius is mentioned in other publications and not as a gay bar. And I think that also straight people went there because, after all, how would they know it was a gay bar? And so, it was a strange, strange thing back in those old days. And the sip-in happened in 1966, I should point out. And Vito Russo getting discriminated against was sometime in the 70s. I don't remember the exact time. But they're going to get a commemorative plaque because they've changed, and it's the oldest one, so there you go. So that rat Republican Governor DeSantis of Florida has signed the Don't Say Gay law, and people are protesting it. Among other things, the Human Rights Campaign has put up some billboards using classic Florida stuff. Says Florida, the Sunshine State, except they have like a red banner across sunshine, and it becomes Florida, the Don't Say Gay or Trans State, and they're putting a bunch of those up. And, of course, Disney has come out to say this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing this, discriminating like this. And DeSantis, who apparently wants to run for president in 2024, this moron thinks he can become the next Trump. He is decided to wage war. You've picked on the wrong guy, he says. And so what they've done is they've started setting it up so that Disney no longer is kind of an autonomous county in and of itself. They own a huge amount of land in Florida, and they have all their hotels, amusement parks, plural, and all of this, and they've operated as a county. Well, the Florida legislature has now rescinded this act that allowed them to do this. There are like, I think, something like 1,800 other places that get to operate like this in Florida. Apparently, it's a common thing. But they've rescinded Disney's because they complained about the law. Now, talk about corporate free speech. This would sort of be a case there. I imagine that Disney will sue over this. And Disney, of course, has deep pockets. They're not going to be, you know, shoved around so easily. And so they're gonna be able to fight this, I imagine. And, Mickey Mouse is going to kick DeSantis' ass, I think, in the end, because this is clearly over political speech. And I think it is a free speech issue. So we'll see how that goes. But Jesus H. Christ, that is a terrible law, and that thing needs to get repealed, and so does DeSantis. So I have one thing to say about the Science Times issue of April 12th. It was for the birds. It was all about birds. I brought up Shakespeare's birthday, so it's appropriate to bring up this particular story. Involves a guy named Eugene Schieffelin. You may have heard the story about this guy, although you may not know his name. I didn't remember his name. This is the guy who supposedly in like the 1890s decided he wanted to bring the birds from Shakespeare's plays to America. And it is said that in the 1890s, he released a bunch of starlings, various other birds, but starlings. And the starlings from there went on to, like, invade every part of North America and take over a whole lot of stuff. So, for quite a while, Mr. Schieffelin has been blamed for starlings, which can be very annoying. And in some places, they're really beyond annoying. And so his name has been Mud, which is another story. But now we have researchers looking into this. And Natalie Hoffmeister, a doctoral candidate at Cornell University, says, quote, It does seem like there's a lot of ambiguity as to whether or not the New York birds were really the beginning of the Starlings expansion, unquote, because he released them in New York, I think in Central Park, in fact, and the story is that they spread and they went all over the place. But research is showing maybe that's not the case. There is evidence against his being the reason why these things happened, because wild starlings were caught in Massachusetts in 1876, far from any of the documented introductions where they were brought to America. So they're saying that this really didn't happen. The Shakespeare-related bird story and Mr. Schieffelin appear to be getting debunked. He released the birds after the same kinds of birds were found in Massachusetts. So this looks like it's not really there. Starlings do affect other birds, but other birds affect other birds too. And it says in the New York Times, nearly 3 billion birds have disappeared from North America since 1970. The European starlings here are counted among them, and they have an estimated decline of 49% over the same time frame. And starlings are also declining rapidly in Europe. And a part of what's happening is they do get into things. They will eat your grain. They caused a crash. On October 4th, 1960, there was an Eastern Airlines Lockheed L-188 Electra. It took off from Boston en route to Philadelphia, and it ran into a flock of starlings. It scared them as it took off, and they flew up. And this woman, Joan Berry Hale, was a stewardess on this particular aircraft. She said, "I could see out the window in the back, and I saw all these black birds fly by. And the plane's propellers ingested hundreds of starlings, which wrecked the engines, and the plane crashed." She says they didn't find the front-end crew until they pulled the nose up out of the mud the next day. Only 10 people of the 72 on board survived, and Ms. Hale is one of them. So they do cause problems. They also eat grain. Out in the Midwest, they can be really bad. Plus, in some rural places, what happens with a starling is they send out scouts to find where to roost for the night. And those scouts report back, and they all go finding a certain set of trees. If it's a small bunch, it's one tree. If it's a whole bunch of bunches, it's a whole bunch of trees. And they go there, and these are not silent birds. They make a lot of noise. And in rural areas, people are plagued by the noise of starlings. You can see them flying in these murmurations. And in these murmurations, there are just huge numbers of them, and they fly in very interesting patterns because, you know, they take cues from one another. There are pictures of these things, and they form patterns in the sky. And so some people want to get rid of them a lot. And there's a pesticide called Starlicide, and it's specifically to kill off starlings. And they use this in some places. I don't think we use it in New York because they're not that annoying in New York. Although right around now, you can tell the starlings because the male's beaks have turned yellow. It's mating season for starlings and a lot of other birds. But with the starlings, the male beaks turn yellow during mating season. So if you see a small black bird with a yellow beak, it's probably a starling, and it's probably not alone. So the story I've heard since I was a little kid about this guy introducing starlings, a plague upon North America, turns out it's most probably not true because they found birds in Massachusetts years before he's alleged to have released any. Plus, they've got some pictures in here. One of the most amusing photographs is a photograph of a starling standing on an anti-perching spike at LaGuardia Airport. this odd thing with little weights on wires that probably move in the wind and are supposed to scare the birds. And it's perched on it. So, yeah, it doesn't work all that well. There you go. I think that's been it for Back of the Book for this week. We'll be back next week. Coming up next is
Arts Express with Prairie Miller.
It's going to get nicer. It's getting warmer. It's late April now. We are now entering mid-spring. The trees are leafing, and oh, yeah, it's getting nice. Flowers are out there. Those of you who like to wander around out there and take your life into your hands, you go out and you enjoy that. The rest of us will look out the window and say, oh, it's looking nicer out there. Meanwhile, remember what that Watching Out for Giant Comets Dormouse said.
Winding your way down on Baker Street, lighting your head and
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
And BAI buddies help WBAI live into the future. Many thanks to our new April buddy, Santiago from the Bronx. Thank you. His favorite show is All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp. Thank you to Ellen Grove from Brooklyn, a new buddy in honor of Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Tamika Garrett from Scotch Plains, New Jersey says she loves WBAI. She's been listening for over 20 years. Whenever I'm outside of New York City, Tamika says, I'm very thankful I can still listen online. Let's keep Free Speech Radio alive. Thank you, Tamika, and thanks to all WBAI's new buddies, sustaining members who are part of WBAI's fabric, which keep the radio station operating. Also, thanks to Bill Avon from Teaneck, New Jersey, a new buddy. Lisa from Sparta, New Jersey, is a buddy in the name of Green Street Radio with Doug and Patty Wood. A listener from Jackson Heights is a new buddy in the name of The Sweet Spot. That's heard Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Mia from the Upper West Side is also a new buddy in the name of all WBAI shows. And Rodney Deese, he's from Brooklyn. His favorite show is Basir Amchawi's Education at the Crossroads. Thank you for being a new WBAI buddy, Rodney. If you'd like to become a BAI buddy to help WBAI keep broadcasting at 99.5 FM, keep streaming at WBAI.org, then please go to our website, WBAI.org, and click on Buddy and sign in and become a sustaining member of WBAI in the name of your favorite show or in the name of all programs, or call 212-209-2950 and join the other buddies and help make WBAI strong into the future. Thank you.